Let's go to your case, Len.
Hey, this is a 50-year-old gentleman who, on a first time out of the gate PSA screen, had a PSA of 47, and on rectal exam had a T2B nodule in many respects similar to Tom's patient. Prostate biopsy, it was all Gleason 8 and 9 cancer, no Gleason 10. However, on this particular man, we did do further imaging on him because he really had a massive prostate. It was quite a large gland, and there was a concern that there might even be rectal wall involvement, so it might even be a T4 lesion. The prostate was at least 120 or 130 grams. Again, healthy man, long discussion.
It's a sort of lifestyle, family situation.
Healthy. He's an active businessman. He was divorced, had a couple of kids, was involved in another relationship at the time. And
what was his state of mind once he had the
biopsy? A little overwhelmed. I mean, he was totally overwhelmed. It's odd that somebody with such a large prostate and such extensive disease could be asymptomatic. And he was really asymptomatic. It's not that he had a lot of voiding symptoms or anything. It came as a surprise.
Do you think he was kind of out there on the internet trying to get information, figure out what's going on, or was he too stunned to do anything?
95% of people are out on the internet. And if they're not on the internet, their daughter, their son, their brother, their cousin, their uncle is out on the internet.
Any impression about the quality of information that people are getting off the internet?
I think it is highly variable. And I think that what you have to do as a guiding clinician is tell people that, look, go to the big sites, go to the major recognized sites, your local cancer center, American Cancer Society site, major nationally recognized cancer center site, and get your information. Avoid smaller sites that you really can't validate where the information comes from.
How active was he in this? Was he by himself or was anyone with him?
He brought his wife in with him. The typical patient today, traditionally the last 10 years in our multidisciplinary center, hand people a standard package of information. It's clear today to me that 90% of people come in with some package of information in hand that they've already looked at and often have very preconceived notions, which often are true or often are not true. And I use a quip with people sometimes who present to me very large reams of binders and begin questioning me about things. I say, look, I can go on the internet and get the flight manual for 747. Just as big as the stack that you have, but do you want me flying that airplane? And I think that kind of gives people a reality check. I tell them there's 600, 700 papers a month relating to prostate cancer pouring out in the world literature. No one can know everything that's going on. You have to look at the consensus of what leaders in the field are saying about the disease to make your decisions.
Tom, clearly people are coming in a totally different informational state than they did 10 years ago, mm-hmm. I think. 10 years ago. People never got this kind of information from libraries or bookstores, et cetera. Good or bad thing?
Good insofar as it gives them an idea of potentially what they may be facing. Bad insofar as it is frequently extremely biased. I do feel that a lot of the patients come to you with a preconceived idea, depending on who has given them the news as to what's going on, and depending on where they have come from, it can be a very different option that they've been given. Sometimes you're looking at cryo, or HIFU even has come into me on occasion as being presented as a mainline treatment option. And I find that disturbing.
So let's get back to this patient. Mike, what would you be thinking at this point?
As Lenny described, yes, it's a young patient, but this is high-grade disease. He has locally advanced disease with suspicion for rectal wall invasion. As far as the rectal wall invasion, I think it would be important to clarify that because, in particular, even for radiation-based modalities, we would want to get very specific information. If they're true rectal wall invasion, that has to be dealt with very carefully and cautiously, even in treatment planning aspects. You could run the risk of a fistula if there actually is frank rectal wall invasion and you treat that. Lenny also described a very bulky and large gland size, I think 120 grams. And in such a situation, I think while we could use the various treatment options, surgical or non-surgical based approach, I would favor a non-surgical approach for the patient with neoadjuvant, androgen ablative therapy, hormonal therapy upfront, achieve volume reduction. And probably with such a large size prostate, you'd need at least about 4 or maybe 6 months of hormonal therapy. At our institution, we would re-image the patient again and get a better idea of what was accomplished during that neoadjuvant phase of therapy and probably treat the patient with high-dose radiation and concomitant hormonal therapy. And somebody like this, based on the randomized trials, would probably require long-term hormonal therapy as well, whether it's 2 years, 3 years, based on probably more in that line, as long as the patient tolerates it. And we don't have a finite period of time, but we're watching the patient, looking at their quality of life. the number of patients who just say they've had it with long-term hormonal therapy and would like the option of getting off of it, and we follow and counsel those patients accordingly.
Any other diagnostic modalities you'd like to see in a patient like this? Again, endorectal MRI, for example?
Absolutely.
Anything else?
With such bulky disease, probably be a good idea to scan the abdomen as well, just to understand whether you're dealing with retroperitoneal lymphadenopathy. Unfortunately, some of our imaging studies are really not that helpful in looking at nodal disease, and that's a significant limitation.
This is the very guy who I think he needs a bone scan before you start out doing anything. And then if the bone scan is positive, that's really you're cooked and you know what you're going to do. On the other hand, if the bone scan were negative, this is the guy we would do a prostatin scan on, absolutely, because we are looking for central abdominal uptake in this chap. There was a presentation at ASCO this year by Hausmann on central abdominal uptake, and the patients who had that were at least 3 times more likely over the 4 years of follow-up to have died of prostate cancer. Used to be it was thought to be blood pooling and uninvolved areas of the mesentery blood supply. It's not. It turns out that this is probably prostate cancer. And if you think of the anatomy, it makes sense that it follows the arterial blood supply. And I think there's a number of post-mortem studies which show that pelvic lymphadenopathy actually is less frequent than retroperitoneal lymphadenopathy when you look at these patients at post-mortem. So this is the guy that... It's interesting what you said about the radiation. You'd use high-dose radiation. Would that be a combination of IMRT plus brachy, or would it just be IMRT alone?
I think it depends on the geometry of the anatomy as well. But I think both of those approaches would be reasonable. The concern here regarding the brachytherapy is the size of the prostate. Mm. We generally would expect, as you know, about a 30 or 40% volume reduction. If you're dealing with a 120 or 150 gram gland, you're not going to get that much below 80 grams. Mm. And that may represent a technical challenge for the brachytherapy. Not as much for the external beam IMRT, right, for instance.
Well, looking at a chap like this, if it turned out that all his staging studies were negative and Lenny feels that there may be some rectal wall involvement, there could be a reasonable case made for, again, using hormonal therapy to shrink the prostate, maybe to downsize him a bit. And then I would certainly be tempted, and I don't have any basis for saying this, but I would feel that this man would be better off if we could get his prostate out. He is going to have radiation. He is going to have chemo, or probably have chemo, and probably have hormonal therapy as well. But the question becomes, at 50 years of age, we know even if we use radiation plus hormones, it's probably coming back. And he already has a fairly large gland. If it is involving, or if there is areas around the rectum, he's the kind of guy I'd be looking at potentially down the road as having trouble and needing a colostomy. You know, because he's going to get it around that area.
You raise an interesting point. I think this is an emerging notion that is being at least vocalized by a number of urologists, and that long-term, if you give a patient radiation and they have a bulky disease in their prostate, there's a very high likelihood of symptomatic local recurrences down the road. And when we've looked at least at our own data, and I think other institutions as well, when you deliver a high dose of radiation, as opposed to these lower conventional doses, and throw in the hormonal therapy as well, when we've looked at symptomatic local recurrences, they're still very rare. So,
how about local recurrences, period?
Well, biopsy-proven local recurrences, I think it depends upon the extent of disease, and that's maybe 30 to 40% of very bulky tumors are going to have biopsy-proven disease with doses of 75 gray, and I think higher doses are going to lower that. But symptomatic local recurrences, that's unusual.
But my concern with this is that we know that hormones worked with 70 gray. We know that. Now we're moving up to 78 gray plus brachy and hormones. And if it is a sensitizing agent, there may be another side to that. It's your therapeutic index. I mean, if you increase your efficacy, there's a strong possibility you may also be increasing your toxicity. I mean, I agree with you. I don't think there's an initial toxicity, a huge toxicity. But as you go out to your 10 and 12 years, you may see a lot of problems coming from that.
So then let's follow up with this patient. What happened?
What happened with this gentleman was he was evaluated by colorectal surgery, who thought that, yes, he possibly had some rectal wall invasion. He was put on total androgen blockade. He sought multiple opinions at least four different major centers and came back totally confused because every time he went to a different center, he got a separate collection of information.
What was he offered?
He was offered everything that you might imagine. He was offered upfront surgery. He was offered external beam plus hormones. He was offered upfront chemotherapy. Every place he went to, he was offered a completely different Pandora's box of treatment options. And, you know, he ended up coming back to us and he said, look, I have confidence in – the only reason he came back to us because he had confidence in us. He goes, what would you do? And I said, well, you're in uncharted territories
here. You
can't
get that off the internet, can you?
Yeah, no, you can't do that. That's the 747 flight manual concept here, coming home to roost. And basically what we did was we sort of sat down in a multidisciplinary setting. We said, look, with the colorectal surgeons and with the chemotherapy team, and we said, what would be reasonable? Everybody agreed as a platform androgen blockade in this man. So that was the easy thing. What we did with this man, he ended up getting six cycles of Taxotere, 21-day cycling. We re-imaged him, and he ended up having a pretty good involution, as Mike suggested, of his prostate. He got down around 60 or 70 grams. At that point, we reevaluated and we restaged him. Everything was looking very good. Colorectal even thought that he might even have less involvement of the rectal wall. So,
how did he do with the docetaxel?
He did fine. Typical hair loss and other constitutional symptoms.
Kept working.
But he did pretty. He took some time off, but he was an insurance salesman, so he took some light days and things like that.
Is he on a trial?
No, this was a couple of years ago. This is before we really had any good trial for him to offer. He's out about 4 years now. So
what happened?
What happened with him, after about 12 months of being on hormone therapy, completing everything, we went ahead with the preconceived possibility of him requiring exoneration, colostomy, all sorts of things. We went into the operating room. We did a radical prostatectomy. Surprisingly, the prostate came out incredibly easy. No nerve sparing, obviously, involved in this gentleman, not even attempted. And we actually did some biopsies of his anterior rectal wall when we were done, very extensive biopsies that in the frozen section all came back negative. Nodes were negative, so we were pretty ecstatic. Unfortunately, what happened was on the final pathology, they said, well, you got a few foci of tumor left on his rectal wall. After he recovered from the surgery, he got postoperative radiation therapy and ended up finishing up a total of 3 years of hormone therapy and got a fairly substantial dose of radiation. I think they got him up to about 68 gray, somewhere around there. He got a total of 3 years of hormone therapy. The man's now been out a year and a half. He's off his hormones, and he's NED. The only problem with him is his testosterone's on the low side. His testosterone's still sitting around 100. So we're cautiously optimistic, but he's undetectable. His quality of life is good. He's continent. Obviously, he's not potent, but he's got all his organs intact. And so we're cautiously optimistic. But again, I tell this man understands no one's going to decree him a cure until he passes away from some other cause.
I'm curious, Lenny, why did you use such a long duration of neoadjuvant therapy, a year, before you decided to do something?
For the simple reason that no one was really sure what to do with this man. And he kept thinking about it and thinking about it. And we did offer him radiation therapy, and he was he's one of these guys that sort of had the attitude, I want the tumor out of me, doc. If you can get the tumor out of me, I don't want to. We were very sitting on the fence with him and kind of encouraging to think about consolidative radiation therapy. But this was a man actually that wanted surgery. I couldn't deny it to him. And I think his outcome so far is good. But I think that's why we had that 6 month period of going back and forth. His cancer was at least being treated on the hormone therapy. His PSA was sailing down very nicely.
How big was the prostate when you finally got to it?
It was about 70 grams or so.
Still after a
year.
Still
after a year, it was about 70 grams.
Did you get any feel for his overall quality of life during those 3 years and how it compares to now? Is there a difference?
He's much better now.
He
got
better.
Clinically depressed. I mean, he was clinically depressed, and we had him seeing our support psychiatrist, our oncologically oriented psychiatrist that we work with. He was clinically depressed. But at this point, he's off the hormones. Even that little level of testosterone of about 100, I think, is giving him a better sense of it.
In general, when he was on hormones, do you think he felt...
He was depressed. I mean, but it's hard to tell. Here's the problem with hormone therapy. You know, when you look at quality of life studies, it's very often hard to differentiate the hormone effects versus the actual disease and the whole,
Did you have any sense in him how much was physiologic as opposed to sort of psychologic?
I think with him, a lot more of it was psychologic.
It's tough to do.
Because he responded, once we got him into therapy and he saw the psychiatrist and he was put on either Paxil or Prozac or what they put him on, but I don't know if an antidepressive can overcome the systemic effects of a low testosterone. It may have something to do with hot flashes, but he was not troubled by hot flashes. Well, he was just in a great mood.
We had a similar patient, and I guess it would be interesting to discuss. This patient had a depressed testosterone after all was done, and he was asking about testosterone supplementation situation where he has such high-risk disease, and the patients really are looking for something to rev them up a bit. And I'm always very concerned about it and would be interested to hear what other people think.
There's a number of different opinions. I tell all my patients that testosterone is the fuel for the prostate cancer engine. And I think that's the standard view. There's another view out there which says that somebody whose PSA has nadir down appropriately, who has a low testosterone, if you use some of the gels, you can restore them to a level between 400 and 500. And people have even said it could be a trial to see if there's any disease left, because if the PSA bumps, you can stop it again and take them off the hormone. I'm really worried about that strategy, but that has been suggested as kind of a test to see what's going on. I wouldn't do it, but I do think that it's becoming a commonly asked question. I had a patient 2 weeks ago come into my clinic who had at least an 8, doing well, treated with radiation hormones. He's now 4 years out, everything's looking fine. And he wants to go on testosterone. And we spent about half an hour while I told him exactly what I opened this conversation with. It's the fuel for the engine that'll kill you, but still wants it.
One of the problems that we don't have well documented in the literature, and I do this in my practice routinely the last 4 or 5 years since the papers came out showing long-term suppression of patients who get LHRH analogs, everybody who has seen any hormone therapy for anything more than 3 months, we always get a testosterone level with a PSA and follow-up, because you can't really clearly interpret the PSA in the light of a continually pressed testosterone. To me, it's okay, but I don't want to say I feel better if somebody's PSA starts to go up and their testosterone is normal. I hate to say I feel better, because at least I can do something. If a man's PSA starts to go up and he continues to be suppressed to 30 or 40, I get very nervous about that man, because I don't feel like I don't have any good salvage for him, since now he's really manifesting androgen insensitivity.
Refractory disease. And I think another important point is that very often after cessation of hormonal therapy, the testosterone levels will come back, but certainly not to the normal range that they had before. And that will be perceived by the patient in a very, they are still low on their testosterone levels compared to their baseline. And some of these patients still have persistent symptoms of androgen deprivation, although their testosterone levels are, quote unquote, in the low ranges of normal.
Yeah, and that's a good question. We don't have good data out there. We have a lot of data on andropause, but we actually don't have good data on what level of testosterone do you need, for example, for your hot flashes or your hot flushes to go away. Yeah. My impression is it's somewhere around 100. That's my gut feeling when people who complain about hot flashes and then we follow them. Once they get around 100, I think the hot flashes go away. But we don't have good data on exactly when do you feel better, when do you actually get hot flush resolution, when do you get better bone mineralization, at what level of testosterone after therapy.
We actually presented a small series at the Southeastern section this year where we looked at men at the VA who had had hormonal ablation for 5 years or more and then stopped the hormonal therapy, followed their PSAs and their testosterones. And it turned out that if you were under 70 years of age, 70% of those men developed a so-called normal testosterone, meaning that they got above 300. If you were over 70 years of age, only 17% of the men ever got up to that level again. And I think Bowler gave us a hint of that in his 3-year study when 25% of the patients never got back to a normal testosterone.